Good morning.
That's right out.
Everyone okay? So welcome to OpenTech. Our first speaker is Happy Bean, who's going to be speaking about private browsing.
Thanks. So good morning, OpenTech. You're all a lot more awake than I was expecting. I am Happy Bean. I work on web standards and the architecture of the web. I am a member of the W3C Technical Architecture Group, which is nine of us who spend way too much time thinking about how all the pieces of the web fit together and where there are holes and overlaps and whether the web is going in a useful direction and what else needs to be built. And we're really, really good at technical navel gazing. But one of the things that's come out of all this is a rant for me about private browsing. I need to make clear this does not represent the consensus of my colleagues on the tag. We all have different points of view on this one. But I think there is a big problem with private browsing, and I want to tell you about it. So let's start with this. You're a pretty technical group. Who thinks private browsing is important? All right, good. I'm speaking to the right audience. Private browsing is, I'm totally winging it, I don't have my notes. Private browsing is absolutely important. Privacy on the web is absolutely important because we have so many things to worry about. We have employers who are looking over our shoulder at what our traffic is doing. We have ISPs that are doing similar. We have all kinds of monetary value in our browsing history, and privacy value and personal value. And unfortunately, not everybody out there is a good guy. Or girl, to be gender equal. There is obviously a lot of information about you in your browsing history and activities, and I think everybody should have a certain amount of control over who has access to that information and what happens to it. So, next poll. Who thinks you know what happens if you turn on private mode? Okay. Hang on to that. Let's talk about the threat models that we're trying to mitigate against. The first one is someone else uses my device. The classic use case we talk about in this situation is buying your partner a gift, which is nice and fluffy, but obviously there's a bunch of others where you just might be doing something that you don't necessarily want anyone else to know about. You might be looking up an embarrassing medical condition or, I don't know, browsing parts of the web that you don't want to be public. Or certainly don't want anyone that who might be sitting at your laptop or picking up your phone after you to be aware of. So that's one threat model and has a whole set of features in the web platform to accommodate it or mitigate against it. Second big threat model, we've only got three to go here, three in total rather, is someone on the network could see what I'm doing. So this is where your employer or your ISP or anyone else between you and the server you're trying to get stuff from or give stuff to is aware of what you're up to. In many ways, we all imagine the pipes of the internet, the transport layer to be completely dumb and the intelligence happening, the interesting stuff happening in the application layer. It gets a little creepy when stuff in the middle knows what's going on. So that's another threat model we need to worry about. And the third threat model is when the site or service that you are deliberately speaking to knows more than you wanted to about you. So this is advertisers tracking you across sites, this is fingerprinting, this is super cookies, this is anything about that service being aware of something that you didn't think it necessarily would. So, we have some mitigations to play with here. We'll do them again by threat model. For someone else using my device, we can treat cookies differently when in private mode. We can not write cookies in private mode to storage that's available after private mode is finished. Or we can, in private mode, not access the cookies that are already there. We can wipe local storage and cache when you're done with private mode. We can clear your history. We can make it so your history can't be accessed for somebody in private mode. We can stop form autocompletes. We can stop saving passwords. We can deny access to saved passwords. We can do the same with downloads list. There's a bunch of stuff we can do to kind of erase the fact that you were doing things in private mode from the context of your browser. I know I'm dragging you through things that most of you are pretty familiar with, but it's important context for where we're going. Mitigations for someone in the network could see what I'm doing. HTTPS everywhere and TLS is a fantastic method of encrypting content and traffic between your machine and the service you're trying to access. VPN, so one step further in protecting your traffic and routing your traffic. And then you can go all the way to Tor. How many of you don't know what Tor is? Any of you? Okay. The really quick version is that it's a method for anonymizing you as the source of traffic and the route that your traffic takes in order to get to a particular service. There's a whole bunch of other stuff to talk about, and I will happily leave that to people like Alec, who can talk about it for at length. But it is a much more robust method of disguising the pathway of your traffic and the source of your traffic. And mitigations for the site or service knowing more than you want them to. We can block third-party cookies, so that's particularly useful for blocking advertisers and trackers on any website that you deliberately go to, which might be hosting other services that would then be aware that you are the same person who was visiting another site where they have a tracker. We can minimize fingerprinting surface area. A lot of the features in your browser, going down to things like the fonts you have installed, are can all be put together to make a pretty unique picture of your browser. And there are ways to minimize potential for that to be unique or to deliberately mess with it so that you look like you're somebody else compared to who you were when you were outside private browsing. We can enable Do Not Track, which is a flag asking sites and advertisers explicitly not to track you. It's then up to them whether or not they obey that, but it's a polite way of saying, please, I don't want to be tracked. We can implement tracking protection by blacklist and have the browser explicitly stop anything, traffic from anything or go to anything that is known to be just a tracking service. So far so good, right? We've got a problem, we've got a bunch of solutions. Private browsing is in pretty good shape, right? Yeah, clearly setting that up for the opposite. Here is the problem. Every private browsing mode is different. They all use different features in different ways, and they have different names. Chrome has, you don't need to actually be able to read this, the message you need to get from this is they don't match. Chrome has incognito mode and guest mode. Incognito mode is primarily for a browser that is generally just you, but you want to hide your browsing context from a particular service, so it's probably still going to be you. Guest mode is, no, somebody else is going to be sitting down at my browser and using it, and I want to hide all of my stuff from them. Firefox has private browsing. And it has tracking protection as a separate mode, which we have on the private browsing. Safari has private browsing. I'm going to talk about all in detail in a minute, but Microsoft Edge has in private tabs. And then Brave, which is my current favorite browser, is fantastic, but it's even more complicated. It starts with a whole bunch of advertising blocking stuff and tracking protection stuff in place as default, and then has an additional private mode. Let's talk about the complexities here. Chrome's incognito and guest mode, apart from operating differently in terms of accessing the stuff that's already stored in your browser about you, they both wipe cookies and they'll cache when the last private window closes. And they both isolate permissions. So if you grant access to camera or microphone in a particular site, when you're in incognito mode or guest mode, it won't persist after you finish, you close the last window in that mode. Firefox private browsing doesn't store new cookies or history or password, but the additional tracking protection mode explicitly blacklists known tracker URLs, which can complicate things like those little tweet this or like on Facebook buttons at the bottom of blog posts, and like a bunch of ads. Safari private browsing won't save changes to existing cookies and won't share browsing history and sessions to iCloud or to hand off to another sort of device when you have your laptop connected by Bluetooth to your phone. And Safari also stops recent searches made in privacy mode from being saved, which is kind of useful. And Safari enables do not track by default in private browsing. Microsoft Edge does the usual thing by not saving cookies in history. It also blocks tracking pixels and malicious advertising, which is a fun bonus. And Brave, as I said, when at install, when shields are up, which is their phrase, blacklists and blocks third-party trackers, blacklists ads, protects against fingerprinting through Canvas, WebGL, WebRTC, IP leakage, and battery status API. The important thing to know about those is that those are particularly specific ways of fingerprinting you. And Brave is built on Chromium. It's the same engine that Chrome comes from. And so as a result, when you're in Brave and you go into private mode, you have all the same features that you have in Chrome private mode. Confused yet? It's a little crazy. In addition, we have a couple of lesser used browsers than I could fit on the screen. We talked about Tor a minute ago. Opera, when you're in private mode, will route your traffic through a VPN to protect you from your ISP or employer or anybody else watching your traffic. Samsung's Internet Secret Mode has a fun little feature where it prevents image capture, screen capture, recording by turning the images black. Okay. So the good news is browsers can compete and innovate, and they're doing that. They're all out there trying to find better ways to keep us private, and that's fantastic. Competition between them is generally good for us as users. And it also means they're not being held up by the standards making process, which does take a while. It usually takes, gosh, I don't know, 6 months, 6 to 9 months for a really fast feature to hit its first implementation, and then probably about 2 years to get through standardization. So that could be a big pain for all of us. The bad news is that we as users can't get used to what happens when we flip a switch. And I regularly use at least 3, probably 4 browsers at once for different purposes. I've got to remember which features are changing in which way in order to then adapt how I'm behaving, what content I'm putting into which forms, what I expect to have happen, how I'm protecting myself in addition to the protection that comes from that specific browser. And I spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff. I really worry about a lot of our users who don't. And I think that it's part of our job as web developers and as standards developers to build a web that is understandable without having to spend your life digging into details to understand how this feature works and why this is different. So I worry about our users. DuckDuckGo did some research with SurveyMonkey I think a year ago, where they found a representative sample of 5,710 Americans. So not quite us, but it's nice to have some research. And they were asking about private browsing. DuckDuckGo is the search engine that prioritizes privacy and explicitly says they won't track their users. The top reason for using private browsing from all these respondents was embarrassing searches. This table, which you can't see very well, is divided between desktop in blue and mobile in green. But the main reason I wanted to show you, it got embarrassing searches first, and then suggestions, and then history, and then I'm using a public computer, and then general, and then finance, shopping, and finally travel purchases. But the main reason I wanted to show this to you is because embarrassing searches while it's clearly a priority for a number of users here, is not something that most private browsing modes will mitigate against. Safari is the only one that says in its guidance to users that your recent searches aren't included in the results list when you use the smart search field. So you create a mismatch between expectations and the reality of the features. There isn't that much research on this topic yet, and I would love to see more. That's one of the things that I hope you will take from this talk. The other thing I'm worried about is that we may be holding back the web in general. As I mentioned when I was introducing myself in the technical architecture group, all the different specs for all the features of the web interrelate because they all fit into browsers or they all interact with users and they're all operating with the same data. We have had thus far two working groups say to us as the TAG and to the W3C community in general, we want to be able to say for this feature when users in private mode change the feature in this way. The first one was the presentation API from the second screen working groups trying to create a standard for your, for example, your phone and your big screen to interact for playing games or for tweeting about a TV show, something that needs to be connected. We've also got similar requests from the Web Payments API, who are trying to build payment processes into the browser, and they're particularly concerned about the privacy and the payment rights, the ability to charge stuff to somebody that a user will be giving to their browser when they set this up, and they want to be able to protect that user from misuse from somebody else using it or from additional information leakage when the user is particularly concerned. So they have said, we want to be able to write into our specs in private mode, please make these changes, but we don't have a spec for private mode. So it's impossible to write down how to interact with it when it is this woolly table of constantly changing features that I showed you a few minutes ago. So, conclusion, we desperately need more data. We don't want to stop browsers from innovating. Privacy is critically important now and is only going to become more so as the web continues to develop and people use it for more parts of their lives and to put more data into it and through it. We need to do more UX research to help design interfaces so that users can be informed and safe about what data they're putting where and how they're protecting themselves. We need to understand more about how this can interact with other parts of the web. I suspect that as soon as we have a concrete spec of something that is private mode, more of the features of the web are going to want to interact with it. So as a result, we need to figure out what out of this long list of features we can standardize and we should standardize, and what we should leave open for user agents and browsers to continue to develop. The last thing we want to do is hold back progress. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ali. So our next speaker is Greg Shorwicker, who is going to be speaking about Warrington Internet Affair efforts.
I'm sort of Their aim is to kind of try out some thinking on what I hope will be a friendly audience. Talking about some of the things we're trying to do at everyone, and some of the change we're hoping to make. And because it's Saturday, and I'm about to give a very kind of quick run through economics and the world and misery, I thought we have some jelly that was. Right, Dot Everyone, in case anyone doesn't know, is a think tank where we're kind of new and old, in as much as we've sort of been around for about a year and a half, but I think we only started probably this year. I took over as CEO at the end of last week, and that has been a little bit of time of stopping things and starting things and starting again. And the thing that we're interested in is fairness. And what I quite like about this is it is a good, galvanising, slightly meaningless slogan that I hope you see on placards everywhere. And the things that we mean are really about the bringing up the upper half of the world. It feels as if we move to a point where the web particularly is really driven by capital. And that we've had lots of interesting conversations in the team actually, where you know we were talking about, well, this was all intended to be like a great open space to really bring us together. And it isn't, and we can care, and that actually the kind of correctives that are needed are slightly different now than simply being open and available. And the things that we're thinking about are, I suppose, much less technical, and they're much more about public understanding and making things, like taking things out of the black box in order that everybody can have a clearer view of what they're doing, choosing, and with. We're interested in people on the street, leaders, people in government, people in corporates, and that actually it isn't only up to people who are making the internet, it's actually up to, I suppose, the kind of bigger economic important people. And fairness is an interesting the work. As the parent of the 4-year-old, I hear a little bit, it's not fair. And it's like easy to whinge. But actually, we're kind of, as I was saying, in a place where things have kind of moved a bit too far the other way. And it's happened quite quickly. And it's happened while I think there was maybe a lot of optimism and people were kind of thinking that it was okay. And that one of the reasons this has happened is because life is complicated. We're not only voters or workers or learners. We're mixed up people who move in different ways all the time. And that if there's a thing that I'm really interested in as an individual, it's kind of how can we take things out of the map box. So I've been working in technology for 20 years, and there is more I don't understand than I can do. And so if that's it for me, that's presumably the tip of the big iceberg. And that I want to be able to have good conversations, make it easy to choose things. And the reason this is the good is because, you know, it could be amazing. There could be like all of this. And but actually, we've had like the problem with the optimism of everyone is that not everyone has the same values. Like, you know, this happens. Like, the thing about being open and available, it expects that everyone is doing it on the same terms. And that actually, values aren't the same. And it means they're making this weird movement, right? So I was at an event on Wednesday where there were lots of people who work in the chronic community talking about the problems of regulating the internet. And you know, obviously there's an issue here that if you're in a government, your laws and cultures are native to your country. The only way to impose those on others is war. Right? But actually, if you're a corporate and you're creating a conservative business, it's loads easier. And that actually, the way that cultural norms are able to radiate out of a tiny, tiny base is creating lots of change that we as individuals, as countries, don't really have good ways of understanding what we're talking about. And that, I can't really remember the thing that was happening here, but this is amazing. Yeah. And there's a hat in a Christmas hat, if you can't see, and then pizza. So yeah, that as well. But otherwise, like the other problem is that if you go back to here, this happens. Like, if we're in a place where we don't have shared values and we don't have shared understanding, that rather than respecting the laws and the values of individual nations, we're kind of in a place of consumer status, where actually this happens, which is less amazing than this, I think. So the idea that Denmark has an ambassador who is dealing with Silicon Valley as if it's a country, at the same time that we've seen the problem of a businessman becoming president, this is like the beginning of a lot of dark stuff. And that there's other kinds of power. Everyone has probably seen this, and it probably resonates with me more than a lot of people here, I imagine. These are the nine men who write the Facebook timeline algorithm. And they influence the things that 1.9 billion people see. So, you know, they have loads of power. They have more power than maybe lots of legislators. And the problem that we have is there aren't kind of good ways of opting out of that. There aren't ways of challenging it. And that in the meantime, even if you are opting out, it just carries on. So if you're looking at businesses that aren't fueled by data, they're just going to carry on eating and eating and eating and eating. And that actually, I suppose the reason that this is all interesting and it is worth intervening is when we're reaching complete reform. There's only a certain amount of time that advertising can carry on funding things. There's only a certain number of clicks. And that actually, I think we will come to some nutrition points and there will be opportunities to create other kinds of value. Because, you know, we have a responsibility as individuals to look after each other and the world. I don't think that happens if we're allowing kind of those other systems to carry on. And without kind of going on about your Facebook, the other issue here is that so there are more people who use Facebook every month than live in the biggest country in the world. And that's, you know, and interesting. But the problem is, previously, if you were like unhappy or computing power, there are ways of doing it. You can revolt, yeah? You can rise up. But that isn't possible. So, what next? And I'm obviously about to come to you that I have a team of 12 people and sitting in an office about the morning away is able to resolve this all now. But maybe not true. So the thing that we are interested in is, I suppose, giving a voice to this and creating mechanism for change. We have a kind of weird thing of being announced on the telly prior to actually existing, which is both a good thing and a bad thing. So my mother is the founder, and she asked a question of the world, and it's, to be honest, taken us about a year and a half to work out how to answer that. But it means that I suppose we're kind of lucky enough to have the ear of different kinds of power. So I'll be honest about it. Some of our founders are corporates. We have good ethics in place to kind of keep that movement from one way as opposed to them influencing us. But that it seems important to us that we are engaged in having those conversations. Yes, because to be honest, anyone can have a point of view. It's harder to make people hear it and respond. And there are three things that we are doing. And it's quite early days, so I don't have lots to show, but I have a bit. And the three ways of creating change that we're interested in is making it easier for everyone to understand the internet. We want it to be easier to know if anything is good, and that means it's easier to make it, it's easier to choose it, it's easier to know who you're working for, it's easier to commission it. Yeah? But lastly, and I think the most interesting thing to me, is you need to think about alternative values. Because I think the value is currently equated to capital. And that in order to make the internet rounder and more interested and varied, that actually we need to have good ways of promoting and expressing alternative value. And so we're looking to make three kinds of change, to individuals, to organisations, and more broadly. Now I'll just very quickly tell you about some of our stuff. So we've got, I suppose, three areas. And previously, we've got everyone, we've done quite a lot of work on basic digital skills, which is kind of okay, but it goes so far and no further. Like, so that actually you're not really encouraging people to think and understand and challenge. And that what we're working on at the moment, and we're doing some focus groups coming up, is the things about how can we help people who may have no technical expertise at all to engage in a critical and confident way? And we're doing a little bit of work at the moment with the BBC thinking about how to explain the internet. Which it, you know, it could be a thing that nobody is actually interested in, but it's sort of a public health messaging, you know, for the internet. We are, I mean, in tandem, trying to work out what responsibility is and how it looks. And we've got a couple of things happening now. We're experimenting with what a fair trade mark looks like. How do you know as a
a member of the public that anything is good as opposed to bad, I suppose. And how do you and how can we encourage and help organisations for making things to keep going through the stumbling blocks? We've got a couple of organisations we're about to work with to do, I suppose, observational research and see how things can go wrong or right in order to understand more about that. And we're currently, if anybody is interested in adding to it, we're collecting like a big directory of responsible and ethical initiatives, because I think like the thing that is really clear to us is that lots of things happen, lots of people are trying really hard, but often I think we don't break through. And how can we intervene to help that? And the other area is kind of actually thinking about us as people. So it's all very well moaning and saying, you know, this is terrible. What are the alternatives? And we're currently doing some research. We're really, I think, passionately interested in diversity. We are kind of poking around at the meaning of that and how that will be, I don't know, kind of making our culture different. And we're also doing a little bit of work thinking about alternative futures. Like how can we project and encourage different things in order to change the world longer term. And we've got a first, like probably mature programme that brings all these things together. We're trying to change how people think about being the leader. I've worked in lots of organisations where being the kind of person who digitises an organisation or creates the changes is quite heroic. And the thing that happens quite often is it's not about changing an organisation or transforming it or changing its values. It's about an individual coming in and beating everybody up and saying, leave and it's all over. And I think we're much more interested in how to create proper sort of long-term change. And that's it. I mean, it's early days. I'm hoping we'll have a lot more interesting things to talk about over the year. And if anyone is interested, say hello. And I'm done. Thank you.
So we've got like 5 minutes some questions whilst I let the speaker sets up. So everyone can have a quick think about questions. Put your hand up, I will run back to the board with a microphone.
When you
you're buying something and you type in your name and your address in each one of those fields, quite often when you're back at Amazon, you've been at Amazon before, you type in the first letter of your name and it shows you underneath, it prompts out your name. That will not happen in, depending on which browser you're using, it either won't show you the ones that it had stored from the past, or it won't store the one you put in then for future times you see that same form, or the same field in the same form. Does that help?
I think so, yeah. I agree with you that it will show you the previous ones even if you browse the browser form, if that's what you meant.
It depends on the browser. Some do it, some don't.
Probably time for two more, so it's back over there. So the Thunder Go survey was interesting, not least because it made me think about native apps and how native apps on the web relate in terms of privacy and private browsing. Are there kind of equivalents for native apps, or is this like, does everyone just do their embarrassing stuff on the web, or like, I don't know, I'm intrigued.
The short answer is I don't know, and I would love to know. Obviously, there is a lot of room for anyone to create separate browser instances or private mode instances or even download a separate browser for separate activity. There's a lot of work going on trying to correlate who you are across browsers and across sessions. Sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not. And then inevitably within each browser you have your choice of search engines. So there are variables in the equation to mix up. But I don't, the usual answer with internet behavior, as you well know, is that everybody, most people leave the defaults. So my guess is probably not, but I'm also surprised at how much more ad blocking we're seeing, particularly extensions, which you know you have to go out and explicitly install. You've got to make the effort. And so there's a bunch of reasons that prompt users to change their behavior in that way that might also influence the kind of behavior you're talking about. But I'd love to see real research on the subject.
You want the web to give the sun for Rachel, you want to educate people about the web. Don't be too pessimistic, but are you both struggling against a problem where most people have given up trying to understand most things? My dad used to be able to service his car, my car mechanic can't service my car very quickly.
From the technical perspective, I think a big part of building and designing any software is making it understandable or understanding how it then fits into the brains of your users. You know, the whole field of computer interaction was built around that kind of research. I think there may be less, or there may be more layers of obscurity. We may have made more things abstracted, so you don't need to understand, I don't need to understand how the car works to drive it. You don't need to understand where your web traffic is going to use the web. But you pick up, you intuit bits about what's happening under the bonnet by how it behaves in certain situations. And the amount of information you can see in the context that your browser or the website gives you about that changes how you understand what's going on. So I don't think that we've all stopped learning, and I don't think that we as developers have can abdicate our responsibility to help people understand.
Yeah, and I add, I think as from a design perspective, that actually it's more about making things understandable. So it's about exposing it, and I guess that's partly one of the reasons I was equating some of the things we're doing to public health messaging, right? There's lots of things that nobody really wants to know until you suddenly have to know it. And that it's probably a bit too early to roll over and just say, I'm not even trying. You know, I think, have a go.
I wholeheartedly agree. Very well said.
Yeah, that's a good note to leave on. Thanks again, Seb. Thank you. So here we have 5 minutes. I'm going to chop the goes to another room. Now it's time to do that. Small public service announcement. The schedule this afternoon has changed. The online version is up to date. So have a look at that.